Labor and Consumer Affairs to order, and we have Representative Crummell here with us this morning, and so we'll open a work session on House Bill 2238. And Janet, give us a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Crummell's bill that you had a hearing on at the end of January, and it would require the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to offer applicants who seek both a liquor sales license, either a new or renewal license, and a lottery game retailer contract the option of a consolidated application. It requires approval of the application form by the State Lottery Commission and specifies that the application will be accepted if the applicant pays the designated fees, for each authority. The OLCC would forward the application to the Lottery Commission along with fees, and then the Lottery Commission would process the application. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell is here, and if there are any questions, representatives from the lottery and from the OLCC are also here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. I'm here on House Bill 2238, and I will be very brief. One of the things that this bill does, it came to you, you'll remember, from the House Interim Committee on Government Operations and Oversight. This was because of some issues with regards to the Liquor Control Commission and the lottery and their ability to really work together. We have several examples in the state of agencies sharing information, and I think this is another opportunity for us to do just that. This will also start opening both the OLCC as well as the Lottery Commission up to starting to do more things online, and in that respect, I think it's a very good system. I'm going to request, Mr. Chair, that you refer this bill to Ways and Means, and the reason is that this is part of an overall budget request that the OLCC has with regards to a technological package that they are moving through the Ways and Means process. As you know, and we've talked about in several ways, the agency, OLCC that is kind of stuck in a Dewey Decimal System. We'd like to get them out of that, get them out of the card system and on to a computerized system so that they can do their work more effectively. This bill being kind of part of that package and their ability to move into a more streamlined and technologically savvy system really becomes kind of part of that package. So I do ask that you send it to Ways and Means. I would also ask that you send it there with a due pass recommendation. And there are no amendments. There's been a work group, you'll remember, from the end of January. We had a work group working on this to see if there were any changes that were really needed in the bill. There are no changes that are needed, and the bill can go as drafted. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. And we have made requests to the Speaker's office to send this to Ways and Means. And so that's what the motion will be. Is there any questions, Representative? Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2238 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2238 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Polley.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Yes.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. With that, I want to open a work session on House Bill 2637. And Janet, can you
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Run down on the bill.
This was a bill heard last week, and it would specify that a mortgage lender surety bond is accessible only to consumers by limiting the right of action against the surety bond to signers of the mortgage application. It results from a Supreme Court decision that interpreted the wording of any person broadly to cover any business or any individual, and this would open the bond quite extensively and make those bonds much more expensive. The amendment deals with another portion of the bill that requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to certify organizations that give exams the continuing education requirements and the loan originator exams. The amendment specifies that an organization certified to approve or provide loan originator exams must be experienced in professional test administration, not necessarily experienced in loan originator exams. That's the Dash 1 amendment, and John McCulley from the Mortgage Lender Association is here if you have any questions.
Thank you, Janet. John, did you want to add anything here?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I'm John McCulley representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. This amendment was actually requested by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, who is the regulator of the mortgage lending program. They were concerned that the original language in the bill was too restrictive, and they wanted a little broader language so they could deal with those who might be able to properly and adequately provide this test administration.
Any questions, John? See none. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2637 have we moved in the Dash 1?
No, we need to.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2637.
Representative Kitts moves we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2637. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2637 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2637 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Committee? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chalkworth.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative Westbrook.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2637 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2637 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. I open the public hearing on House Bill 2374, and Janet, give us a rundown, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2374 would require the State Apprenticeship and Training Council to establish a minimum numeric ratio. Oh. Spelled ratio wrong, of journeymen to apprentices for each apprenticeable occupation. And it specifies that the ratio may not require more than one journeyman to apprentice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Well, let's see. Who's... John, okay. Could I have John Killen and Dan O'Brien and Jeff Dean, please?
We'll see.
I know. If I know, he can get off. This is a good bill.
My little labor.
My answer.
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Killen. I'm the Executive Director of IEC Oregon, the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. I represent about 140 members throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. They more or less look like all the other electrical contractors. They're generally small business. They're concerned about safety. They're concerned about education. And so they've gotten together and formed an association that's lasted about 30 years now. One of the big things they see coming forward, one of the major things they're looking into the future about, is workforce development. They're concerned. They're a lot of areas they aren't able to hire people already, enough qualified journeymen to do the jobs. We're hearing this out of Medford, we're hearing it out of Bend, and we're looking to be hearing it out of Portland real soon. And we're concerned that there isn't going to be enough people to do the work. And it takes a little background on apprenticeship. It takes anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the program and the trade, to get trained and become a full journeyman. So, and for our program, it's 4 years. So from the beginning, once we get them indentured, it takes them 4 years to go through working every day, class in the evenings, get trained in safety and all the codes that they need. After this long recession that we've endured, we're looking towards a big potential boom that I've already mentioned. Additionally, cities and counties are starting to require a variety of things, such as minimum requirements on apprenticeship ratios. In fact, there's even a bill out right now to go statewide, say that 15% or some amount will eventually be required for an apprenticeship minimum. We're having a harder and harder time in various trades of meeting those minimums. We need to be allowed to get more people into the trades, get more people into apprenticeship. We're going to be talking about a variety of reasons today that we're looking at a shortage. We're looking at a lot of retirements coming up. The age of the average journeyman is getting a lot older. We're looking at a boom in construction. We're looking at economic recovery. We just want an opportunity to go to a one-to-one ratio so we can meet this coming need. Currently, to explain, the apprenticeship ratio, the minimum, is 1-to-1 for the first apprentice and then 2-to-1 thereafter, so 2 journeymen to each one apprentice. In other words, if you have 3 journeymen, you can have 2 apprentices. If you have 4, you can have 2 apprentices. If you have 5, then you get to add one, and so on and so forth. Our intention is to create jobs and avoid the coming workforce shortage by changing the ratio and allowing registered and qualified contractors, training agents, to hire more apprentices. The bill says that the State Apprenticeship Council may not adopt a minimum ratio beyond 1-to-1 for an apprenticeable trade. It should be noted that various trades do things differently. There are a variety that probably shouldn't change their ratio that they have now. Some of those might be operating engineers, heavy equipment operators. You need several guys looking out for the one experienced one. There's no doubt. This bill would not affect them. They can still use whatever ratio they'd like. The unions can still use whatever ratio they would like. We're simply asking that you let some of us change the ratio, adopt into a new way of doing business without affecting anybody else, but giving them the opportunity as well if they want it. Several trades do already use a 1-to-1, limited energy technicians, the guys that do your video cable, your telephone, your computer, that sort of thing. They have a 2-year apprenticeship program and they can work on a 1-to-1. As well, residential electricians in some areas can work on a 1-to-1. We're asking for the same sort of opportunity that they have now. Some of the myths you might have heard about ratio or that you might hear today, that it's unsafe to change this minimum. I think we've gone through pretty much all the data we can find, and there is nothing tying safety to an apprenticeship ratio. There just isn't any evidence that there's more workers' comp claims or fatalities or anything tied in there. Another one is cheap labor. I invite you to look at one of the attachments I have there on just what an apprentice makes on an hourly basis. It's not cheap labor. At first, yeah, is the wage a little bit lower? Sure it is. But it's also involving training and time to get these guys up to speed and spend some time with them, making sure that they know the code and that they're doing their job. You may hear today that there's already a venue to handle these situations by going through the Apprenticeship Council. There's actually 2 routes. The first is a long and arduous and merely temporary fix. The second is a statewide effort that takes multiple programs in a given trade coming together and asking for change from the council. The second effort has actually been tried and has been quashed, essentially. They haven't been able to go very far with it. And we'll be hearing more about that a little later, I'm sure. You may hear a theory that if there's two journeymen to one apprentice, then the apprentice is never left alone if one journeyman has to go to the shop or go to the store to get more tools, that sort of thing. They're still out of ratio. If one of those two journeymen leaves, the site's out of ratio, and that apprentice has to get off the site. If they don't, then they can be fined heavily by BCD or by Boley, and we can't have that either. It would be no different than if there were just one-to-one and a journeyman left. You may hear concerns over large companies picking up dozens and hundreds of apprentices and then dumping them off when work slows down. Really not the case. Most companies are, as I mentioned earlier, small companies. They don't have dozens of journeymen. They don't have huge conglomerates. And when they do, frankly, they're mostly union shops or the bigger guys. And they have their own rules and regulations that they have to follow through those agreements. In conclusion, the couple things I want you to hear today are new jobs for Oregonians. We're talking about putting Oregonians that are currently out of work into trades where they're learning a trade, where they're learning how to do a job that they can be doing for the next 20 years. The other thing I want you to hear is a new term. It's kind of like shovel ready, but it's workforce ready. When the time comes and the boom hits and we have to provide a lot of construction, we need a workforce that's ready to go. Thank you for consideration. I'll be available to answer questions at your convenience.
Thank you. I think we'll take all the testimony and then we'll open it up to some questions.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I'd like to emphasize one point here, and you've heard a little bit about that from Mr. Killen, and that is the aging workforce in Oregon. Right now, the Employment Department predicts that by 2012, there's going to be approximately 17,000 retirements in the construction field. Now, those are the skilled men and women who know the trade. They know how to get the work done. What's important about this bill is that we allow more apprentices to come in early enough for them to provide the training that they can give these apprentices so that we will have a workforce that is ready for the boom that will be coming. ABC, currently, we administer five programs. Four of those have a ratio of 1-to-1, and we have a good success right there. As Mr. Killen mentioned earlier, there is no link between safety and the ratio that we can find. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You have testimony too, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Dan O'Brien, president of Current Electrical Construction Company in Portland. I'd like to, with the report that I actually gave you in writing here, there's a report from the National Construction Labor Research Council that talks about craft labor supply from the year 2005 to 2015. Essentially, nationally, we're going to need 185,000 workers in the construction industry every year. The problem is that the workforce is actually aging. We're going to have 6.7 million people leave the workforce during that period of time. This is all crafts, all jobs, and only 2.3 million people of the age, as far as men are concerned, able to come into this industry. That is a huge loss. Our opportunities need to be now. We need to start training people, put them actually in place. We need the opportunity to actually employ them today so we can put them on our job sites and pay them the wages that they're actually going to make. There's kind of a misnomer as far as electrical contractors out there are concerned. The actual size of an electrical contractor, for the most part, is under $750,000. In fact, actually 72% of all electrical contractors are less than $750,000 in size. The actual number of contractors that are over $1 million, $1.5 million are less than 18% of the total contractors in place out of the approximately 8,000 contractors we have in the state of Oregon. So the number of big contractors out there, there's not a whole bunch of them. The number of small contractors, that's most of the small business out there, need the opportunity to train one-to-one. The other big feature as far as electrical, and this is in our case, most of our projects are a one-to-one type of thing. We need to put one journeyman out there and another employee we're now requiring to go out there with one journeyman or two journeymen on that project. We can actually employ another apprentice on that project and have it on a one-to-one basis. I recommend your support, and I'm available for questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Someone said 17,000?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
That's in Oregon?
That's in Oregon alone. The source for that is the Oregon Employment Department are predicting that in the construction industry there will be roughly 17,000 retirements by 2012. And that's going back, Mr. Chair. They did a study ranging between 2002 to 2012. And by 2012.
And is that all trades or just the electrical trade?
That's all trades.
All trades.
Okay. That's correct.
And then another comment was 185,000 jobs in the construction industry. Is that new jobs or total jobs?
That's the need per year for the next 10 years.
Including the people that are within the industry now, then.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, that is actually new jobs. That's 185,000 new people coming into construction, and that's the need every year for the next 10 years.
And so that would be 1,850,000 people?
That's nationally now. Yes, sir.
Representative Katz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't care who answers the question. You had said in all of your research you couldn't find an instance of the ratio dealing with the safety issue, any correlation there. I'm just wondering if you can tell the committee where exactly you did your research.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, the approach for that is right now the U.S. Department of Labor's apprenticeship training has a one-to-one across-the-board recommendation. What we have done is taken a look at workers' comp claims across the trades in different states that are there are BAT states, Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training, SAC states such as Oregon, which stands for State Apprenticeship Training Council. What we did was take a look at the BAT states and compare safety records for those trades, and there is really no link that we could find.
Perfect. Thank you.
If we're going to need 17,000 more people in the trade or in the electrical trades, if we don't train those people, where do they come from then?
They would come from out of state. In previous years, previous times when we've had a workforce shortage, they generally come from out of state.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Yes. Currently, doesn't the State Apprenticeship Council go over these ratios and adopt the ratio standards? And isn't that their purview? I'm just wondering why should we be putting this kind of ratio requirement into statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, groups have gone to the Apprenticeship Council. They've discussed it. The Apprenticeship Council has had a subcommittee work on this recently. And they continue to seem unwilling to consider changing, and for no evidentiary reason that we can identify. So we thought we would go to a different body and see if we could to push.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Do you have another question?
Yeah, follow, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Certainly.
And I had one other question. If we have a one-to-one ratio out there in the construction industry total, it comes to mind, if every journeyman's doing his job of training an apprentice on the job, it seems like that would actually kind of hurt the production of many companies. I mean, who's going to, if you're spending most of your time training, who's getting the work done? Do you have a comment about that aspect of it, or is it you think your productivity is going to be made up because you're able to put more people on at a less wage, or how's that work?
The actual productivity with an electrician is based on the age or the actual level of class that they're in, and they go through seven or eight different levels as they go through the entire apprenticeship program. We actually factor that into our jobs as far as productivity is concerned when we actually estimate the job, that we will have an apprentice out there along with a journeyman. But in the electrical field, in most cases, the jobs are a two-person job. They're not just a one-person job. So an apprentice works right directly along with a journeyman to pull wire, install conduit, mount it on the ceiling, working on lifts to put the put our pieces in place, switchgear, the larger components that we actually put in place. Most of the times, the journeyman and the apprentice are working side by side with each other, and those productivities or rates are put into the actual estimates that we put together.
Representative Hoffler.
Thank you. Sir, in your business, if you had two journeymen and an apprentice on the job site, which one of those workers would you rather be having driving back and forth to the shop? The high-paid, experienced, knowledgeable journeymen who are going to be the most productive, or the apprentice who is not making as much money, is not as productive, and in all likelihood is the person that should be the gopher going back and forth? If you're going to make a business decision on who's going to be going back and forth to the shop.
From our perspective, we do not have a person like that. We actually have a material handler that does that process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts, follow up.
Just so I can clarify. Journeymen electricians aren't gophers. They don't leave the job site running back and forth. They're there being productive, doing what they're paid for and what they do so well. Apprentices are gophers. Laborers are gophers. Just to clarify the statement about the possibility that an apprentice would be left on a one-to-one ratio on a job site if one of the journeymen decided to go back to the shop for tools or materials, that doesn't ever happen. Not in a good, well-run business. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there Representative Kitts?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like clarification from Representative Shalfa. I think my labor brothers and sisters might have an objection to be calling gophers.
I would like
you
to
apologize?
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. As a matter of fact, I enjoyed nothing more than having the opportunity to leave the job site and drive around and
goofing off.
Get out from underneath those screaming, hollering carpenters.
Case in point.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Could I have Irene Weber, John Coulomar, and there's one other person, Deb, is it Martha? Matthews?
Mr. Chair, you want some coffee?
Please.
Hey, I'm here to help.
Good morning, Chair Brown, Committee. My name is Irene Weber. I'm the Director of Apprenticeship and Training for the Area 1 Inside Electrical JATC. We are the Open Shop Electrical Apprenticeship Training Program for Portland and for the Portland area in Southwest Washington. To the left of me is John Coulomar, our committee chair and a business owner. We are here today basically to back up the findings and comments of the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. We have an outstanding opportunity here to have a positive ripple effect instead of a negative trickle-down effect. In the day, and so many comments of the big Walmarts and companies such as that taking over the country, the state, with substandard wages and substandard jobs, we have the opportunity to employ more people at a more middle class to upper class wage than the minimum wage that we're currently seeing the jobs offered at. Currently, I work for 175 different contractors who employ 380 apprentices in our program. They are supervised by a little over 900 journeymen that are employed by these 175 contractors. Our wages start at $10.50 an hour for these apprentices coming in for the first 6 months, and then they increase in 5% increments every 6 months after that. Now, there's none of us here who wouldn't love to give more than a 10% raise every year, and this is what happens to these apprentices when they become journeymen. Currently, the ratios, as described by IEC Oregon, are 1-to-1 for the first one. This helps the small contractor who is a mom-and-pop shop, gets them an apprentice. Then after that, it is a 2-to-1. Now, there is no way that you're going to hear later on that this is an attempt to get cheap labor. Apprenticeship is not cheap labor. By the time you factor in paying two journeymen $30-plus dollars an hour plus a benefit package to be on the job with this apprentice that you are also paying, you're paying for their training, you're paying for their schooling, you're paying for their books, you're paying for labor and industries, you're paying all of this stuff. Apprenticeship is anything but cheap labor. And even if they are gophers, they are not cheap labor. We do have several contractors who do, whether you feel that it's poor business practices or not, send journeymen out to get parts and pieces because another journeyman is there to train that apprentice, and that is what they're there for. We have instances where a ratio of 2-to-1 is confusing for the apprentice. You have two journeymen pulling this individual in two different directions because somebody doesn't want to be digging a ditch because they're a journeyman, or they don't want to be doing something that they feel is substandard to their training, and this person is pulled and confused on exactly what they're supposed to be doing. So a 1-to-1 ratio dictates clarity to the apprentice on who they're supposed to answer to, who is telling them what to do, who is supervising them, and that in itself becomes a safer issue. There again, this is an excellent opportunity. We would be looking at the possibility of employing 100 to 125 with the current ratio that we, if this ratio was expanded with the current contractor base that we have in journeymen in our program. And that's just one area. There are 7 open shop areas in the state of Oregon. If we're able to employ 100 and they're able to employ more, we're definitely looking at helping the economy out. Obviously, the ripple effect, you know, they're going to spend their money. They're going to be out there supporting businesses. We have a lot of these apprentices who go on to become business owners, good taxpayers, employing more people. This is going to give the opportunity for more of this to happen.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Representative Brown, committee. Also, lost my whole train of thought. I hate that when that happens.
For the record, can you give us your name?
I apologize. My name is John Coolamore, chair of the Area 1 JATC electrical apprenticeship. Also, what this will do is for the shop, the smaller shops that deal mostly in service work, you can set up a, you know, you have a van, an apprentice. We have a lot of those that are set up that way, little 3- or 4-man shop, and they have a van and throw an apprentice in there with the guy, and they do service work, small TIs, residential work, that type of thing. Gives them individual training, but also when they, if you do get a bigger job and you have to pull a couple of those vans into to help out, you're not no long, you won't be out of ratio because now you'll have, you know, the van with the apprentice and come in and you'll be complete within ratio in that aspect. I don't know from personal experience, I always try to maintain under ratio as far as if I have 6 journeymen, I'll have one maybe 2 apprentices. I'll try to make sure that I don't ever want to be out of ratio. And even with a 1-to-1, from personal experience, I wouldn't top it out. It gives you some flexibility for sure, and I don't see a problem with it. More than likely, even with a 2-to-1, the apprentice is always going to be directed by one individual, no matter what. You hit the job, you're with him, go, or you're with her, go, however it is. And it does give opportunity for the growth, for the increased work, which is, you know, it's promising. I'm glad to see it. I'm glad to see the projections are out there showing us coming out of this little blip we had. And I would like to see us on top of it and ready. And, you know, we don't want a bunch of first-year apprentices hitting the workforce if it comes in and we load up the apprenticeship program to kind of accommodate for something that's all of a sudden now happening. We'd like to progress it so that we have people in all stages of the apprenticeship program and able to actively participate in the workforce, where you can have an 8th-term apprentice in there working who is more knowledgeable than the guy who's just starting out and has brand new tools in his pouch. You know, we want the well-rounded aspect on the job site. I don't know anybody who wants a bunch of green apprentices. They're great. They are great for getting coffee and donuts, I do admit. But, and as an apprentice, I'd like you to get that because I always got my own free. But from our standpoint, I did talk to some of the contractors on the board, and we would like to see more flexibility in the ratio. And this would give that flexibility. As a board, we wouldn't necessarily have to make it that across the board. We'd have some discretion there, but it would give us more flexibility from where we are now. It would open that up. And you know, as a board, we have to be responsible with our contractors and with our apprentices. They are ultimately our responsibility. And we take that job very seriously. And if there's any questions?
Thank you, John. We'll take Deb's testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Chair Brown and the committee. For the record, I'm Deb Marinos. I'm the Area 2 Chair for the JAKC here in Salem. I am also an electrician. I've been an electrician for 30 years. I've been a contractor for 20 years. But now I do continuing education. And I have to say that we do an excellent job of training apprentices in Oregon. And I also have to say that my concern is that we have the best trained electricians serving our citizens. Electricity is something that we all take for granted, but not much happens if it's not working. The risks are great, both for fires and shocks, and so it's very important that we have very well-trained apprentices. I now train a licensed electrician as a full-time job, and I am here to tell you that not all states offer the fantastic programs that we do. And so I think I'm very much support that we continue this and allow the contractors that are able to train one-to-one, given that opportunity to allow us to have well-trained apprentices and well-trained electricians. Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. John, what is a journeyman electrician? What are they paid an hour?
They're paid anywhere from, what was our average just last year?
$27.62
without the benefits. It's just a straight wage. That was the average of all our contractors. So they range from 26 to 32, and then we average them out. We had 170 contractors that was a pull we were required to do every year, and that's what we base our apprentice wage off, is the average journeyman wage.
Do you have difficulty finding journeyman electricians?
At times, when things are really going fast and hard, you know, they're pretty well out there. When things slow down, it's a little easier to pick somebody up. But as a whole, I myself, yes, it can be difficult at times to find a journeyman out there for a job, and you know, it's hard to. I don't advertise in the paper, and I know contractors that do and don't get a whole lot of response from that. So there is that aspect of it, but there isn't a whole lot out there.
I always found in my company that well-trained journeymen was a different story.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Representative Holley.
Just to follow up a little bit with, thank you, Mr. Chair, with the chairman's question. What is the wage and benefit total package for entry-level apprentice into your program?
Entry-level apprentice starting out at a first term starts out at $10.52 an hour. That is for the first 6 months. The benefit package is dependent on the contractor that he goes to work for, what they provide. The contractor is not dictated in the open shop of what they need to provide, but our contractors provide training, insurance, vacation, sick pay. So I don't know what the individual contractor's benefit package comes up to. That's up to the contractor.
From our standpoint as a board, it's strictly the wage that we govern. As far as apprentices or benefits, that is over and above. I mean, that's whatever the contractor has set up for his employees, and it does vary. It varies greatly across the board. You'll get some who are very generous with benefits. You'll get some that aren't as generous with benefits.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what the average of your contractor's benefit package is then?
I can tell you what mine was.
Well, I was looking for more of a, you know, of the JATC.
As an average, talking to apprentices, I teach at school, so I interact with a lot of them, and most of them have medical, and most of them do have a form of retirement, whether it's a 501K. As far as the contributions, they vary. As far as the medical with, you know, how much they pay out or how much it covers, whether it covers their family, that all varies. But most apprentices have at least medical for themselves after, you know, 90 days or whatever the cycle is that the contract uses, standard 90 days. As far as vacation and that type of stuff, that's anybody's guess.
One more question, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me about how much money per apprentice your JATC spends to move an apprentice into journeyman status?
Education and training. it probably costs over the four-year period for the committee to put the apprentice through the 4 years of school, probably about $8,000 per apprentice, $2,000 a year, approximately, to push the apprentice through the program.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
For your testimony this morning. Could we have Dan Gardner, please? Good morning, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2374, which would amend ORS 66120, would require the Apprenticeship and Training Council to adopt rules to establish a minimum ratio of journey workers to apprentices. With all due respect to the sponsors of the bill, I personally urge your opposition to this bill for a number of reasons. One, this takes away the ability of the local apprenticeship committee to adopt ratios that are in excess of one journeyman per apprentice. It eliminates the council's discretion on ratio consistent with proper supervision, training, safety, and continuity of employment. It would prohibit the council from establishing ratios consistent with proper supervision and safety and continuity. It also could potentially endanger the safety of apprentices due to the potential of multiple untrained, unskilled apprentices on a job site with only one journey worker. It completely disregards ORS 660-155. Most ratios out there are set really in a collaborative manner by a statewide joint apprenticeship committees composed of representatives from every apprentice in every given craft and occupation across the state. In the last 2.5 years I've been labor commissioner, only once has that happened with the roofers, and what they came up with was adopted by the council only a week ago. I'm not aware of, it hasn't happened since I've been commissioner that in the electrical field, for instance, or in any other field, have they gone through this particular process and attempted to establish their own ratio and bring a recommendation before the Apprenticeship and Training Council. It may have some years ago, but it hasn't in the last 2.5 years that I've been there. I would suggest to those who, you know, have objections in this area that they attempt to try the process and work through it before coming to the legislature for relief in this particular fashion. It also ignores, you know, those that have collective bargaining agreement ratios out there. They have to renegotiate in those fashions. As far as the, you know, the potential safety, I haven't looked at the data that they've come up with, but you know, there is a reason why low-voltage apprentices are allowed at a one-to-one ratio. It's pretty simple. It's in the title. It's called low voltage. It's below 110 volts. You know, the reason there is ratios required for higher voltages is because it is more dangerous. There are apprentices in my lifetime in this state that have been killed on the job by not having proper supervision. Logic would dictate to you that it's safer to have two journeymen supervising one apprentice. And quite frankly, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, it's not that the journeyman goes off to the shop or goes off to the donut shop. Usually what happens, and I can tell you as a journeyman myself who's had apprentices on a project, is you may have an apprentice on a larger project, whether you get called by the shop to go take care of an immediate situation on another project, you end up leaving that apprentice there alone unless there's a second journeyman. And that's the situation that happens, and it has happened. People have been injured. It is a matter of safety. I applaud those committees for talking about workforce development and the employment department's data. They are right. There is a workforce shortage coming. Matter of fact, this committee had a demonstration from the employment department. If you look at the data, actually the one craft that is addressing that shortage is the electrical and construction field. Their shortage is much, much less in projections over the next several years because they have been addressing those As far as there was mention here of a state bill requiring a percentage of apprenticeship, there is no state bill I'm aware of requiring that in this session. I do have a bill in requiring that those who do public works contracts be signatory to a joint apprenticeship and training council, but there are no ratios included within those bills. There are some within some of the OTF-3 projects that we've been working on with ODOT, but those are dealing with highway, and actually there's very little electrical on a highway. It's unfortunate. Actually, it's my craft. I'd prefer there to be more, but there isn't. Anyway, I really do believe there is a strong link between safety. This takes away a lot of the discretion from the Apprenticeship and Training Council, and I'd suggest that parties really need to go through the process first to try and see that you can come to common understandings before seeking a bill in the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. The conversation so far has been primarily focused on the electrical trade. Do the comments, are they appropriate also to the other trades?
Well, Mr. Chair, there are different ratios for different crafts, and as I stated, roofers, for instance, they have a one-to-one ratio for apprentices, and they find it's appropriate in that particular profession. Both the committees that exist out there, both the Open Shop and the Union Committee, came together, worked out a ratio together, brought it to the Apprenticeship and Training Council, as well as they also negotiated what the length of the training program and some other elements. It wasn't just that. They brought that to the Apprenticeship and Training Council. That was adopted at the last Apprenticeship and Training Council. That is the process. Actually, I'd suggest to both parties they come together, see if they can work out agreement and attempt to go through that process.
Do you have any concerns about our ability to fill the employment needs in the trades? Yeah, looking down the road, and is your
Mr. Chair, absolutely, clearly. There is a number of workforce issues that are out there, and that's why I'm working with ODOT, particularly on the OTIA 3 project, to see that we are. Also, why I have a bill in talking about that on public works projects, as a public employer, I think government should be the example of how to, what to be, not what to be, as far as it coming to workforce training and development. That bill would require that any contractor doing work on a public works project who has a contract over $250,000, it's not the tiniest of contractors, but the slightly larger ones, that they be part of an apprenticeship and training council. And once they are, they will utilize the use of apprentices. I mean, it's just common business sense to do so.
Representative Kipps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, good to see you. Thanks for being here today. You brought up a good point that if you had two journeymen per apprentice on the work site and one of the journeymen had to leave and go somewhere, that at least the apprentice has got at least one journeyman there for safety purposes. And while I agree that I understand that you disagree with the safety component, the data that the other side has brought forward, that set aside, would it not be true, though, that if the journeyman left and left the apprentice with one journeyman, or whether the journeyman left and left the apprentice alone, that either way they'd be in violation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, absolutely they would be, because they should be at a 2-to-1 ratio. But there's a difference between what the ratio says and the reality that happens in the workplace when you get right down to it. If there were a situation where, for instance, Boley or building codes came onto a project and they had one apprentice, there were two journeymen, one got called away for a few minutes to do an emergency service call down the road, I'm not aware of any contractor ever being seriously fined in any way, shape, or form on that, because it does happen. It's the reality of the workplace. However, it also is a reality that if you have one-to-one ratio and that journeyman is taken away, it's a much more dangerous situation. And you would end up putting Boley as well as the Building Codes Division in a situation where when those did happen, you'd be fining the heck out of a lot more contractors, because you are putting an apprentice in a very unsafe situation, especially if they're a lower-term apprentice.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is there a different fine between having no journeyman on the job site versus having one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, to my knowledge, no, there's no difference in that finding structure. There's a difference in whether the actual compliance officer would go about serious enforcement for a serious infraction or not. You know, there are some logical things that happen in the construction industry. You know, you can have a, for instance, companies I work for have had bank contracts where, you know, we did the service work for all of the Wells Fargo banks. If you happen to be with an apprentice at a Fred Meyer's down the street, and you know there's an emergency service call at a bank that there's something seriously wrong that you need to take care of immediately, you have to go there immediately. Now, it may not be economically feasible to take the apprentice with you, and oftentimes it is not. If you have a 2-to-1 ratio, there would be someone there left for that apprentice. Otherwise, you're forced into a situation of taking the apprentice with you, which is not an economically feasible situation in most contracts where you have a serious relationship with, for instance, a bank doing all of their service work. They don't get too excited about getting a bill for two people being there when the job only required one.
One final follow-up. What's to stop somebody from having a 1-to-1 ratio, and if the situation were to occur where one of your folks showed up at the job site and said, where's my 2-to-1 ratio? He's down the road at another job. The exact scenario that you just came. He had an emergency come up. He's down the road at another job. Do you verify that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, yes, we would, and that actually would probably put a contractor into a situation where we'd keep regular checks on some of their jobs to make sure that isn't a common practice.
Thank you for your answers.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Obviously, our priority here is the first one is safety of the workers. That would be mine. And then I definitely want to see well-trained, well-educated workers, enough of them to do all the work we need to do. But what I don't think we're going to hear about here today is the consumer. I'm putting millions of dollars into a construction project. I don't want an apprentice working unsupervised, wiring up all kinds of expensive stuff. Is there anything, have you heard this kind of concern from consumers? I wish I had thought of this and asked the contractors that were up here. I can't imagine that the consumers, I mean, they have a stake in this, pretty big stake in this too, that they want, it could be a high school, a hospital, manufacturing industry, whatever, that they want an unsupervised apprentice wiring their building. Now, can you just talk to that for me, please?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I have not heard from any consumers that feel that way. I mean, clearly, whether you're a large business like an Intel or a small business like a Plaid Pantry or a 7-Eleven, if a situation happens where an apprentice gets injured on your job, you have a certain liability you may well be facing as well, and I don't think they'd want untrained, unsupervised apprentices on no matter what size the project. I think that they want, so clearly they want a good quality product for their dollar, and clearly most larger employers, you know, have a commitment to workforce and workforce training, but by the same token, they don't want to see work done by those who are unsupervised and untrained without that quality and training going along with it.
And Mr. Chair, just so I can clarify, I don't mean to suggest that anybody that testified before is suggesting that here. But as the commissioner pointed out, I've been on my shared job sites. All kinds of things happen. In reality, if it's 1-to-1, we're going to have an apprentice out there alone. It's going to happen more times than we care to think about. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that is unfortunate. It does happen, and the less we can keep the more we can keep those incidents to a minimum, the safer I think we are as an industry. And you know, I think clearly that by allowing the Apprenticeship and Training Council to have its own flexibility, we can make sure of that.
Thank you, Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Gardner, for coming. You know, just to address the looming work shortage and trying to make sure that we have a workforce for the future, do all contractors you know, belong to JATCs to start with? Or, do they have apprenticeship programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, no, not all contractors do, in fact, belong to Joint Apprenticeship and Training Councils. A number do, some don't. There is no state requirement requiring them to have a commitment to workforce development or workforce training. Like I say, I do have a bill in that would require that on public works projects, if your contract, your individual contract for that contractor, be it electrical, plumbing, whatever, is over $250,000, then you have to be signatory to a Joint Apprenticeship Training Council. The theory being, if they are signatory to it, they will access and use apprentices.
So, follow, Mr. Chair. So it'd be fair to say that if we were really concerned about making sure we have a trained workforce and bringing new people into the industry, that we would follow a model of utilizing apprentices. And from your bill, your idea is that we require that kind of commitment to training from contractors, and certainly the industry would be supportive of that, would they not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I would think the industry would. Some of the industry has been supportive of it, some have not. I certainly look forward to all of those in the industry with a strong commitment toward workforce development that I've heard today. I look forward to having their support.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions? Thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate
you
coming today. Could I have Jessica Adams and Dan Graham, please? Is Jessica here? Yeah, she's clear back in the far corner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris Adamson, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We take no position on House Bill 2374, but at your invitation, we're here today to talk about the apprenticeship system as a whole, as well as a bill that we had introduced and what our thoughts are about trying to address the issues that we believe are of concern in the industry and what we're doing to try and remedy those issues. With me today is Dan Graham, who is our workforce manager and AGC, who will be telling you about AGC's approach to workforce, about the apprenticeship programs that we're so proud of, as well as a bill that we're working on. House Bill 3205, that is in front of you, deals with a few issues that we've had in the apprenticeship arena, primarily a needs test, as well as some other programmatic choices in the apprenticeship law that have been of concern to AGC, though we're proud to be working on those issues, and I'll let Dan address those things, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. As you've heard, I'm Dan Graham, and I'm the workforce manager for the Associated General Contractors Oregon Columbia Chapter. I'm here today to outline AGC's strong commitment to education and skills training in general, and to apprenticeship training in particular. As you may be aware, AGC represents a broad spectrum of employers and workers in the commercial sector of the construction industry. We have large and small member firms, and both union and open shop firms performing a wide variety of services within our industry. We can tell you that our members understand the importance of education as a fundamental underpinning to the operation of safe and profitable construction businesses. When we say we support education and training within our industry, from apprenticeship through supervisory to management levels, we mean it, and we back it up with financial support and voluntary service. We support these educational programs without respect to union or open shop affiliation because we want all our members to participate fully in the development of the industry's current and future workforce. We introduced House Bill 3205 because it is very much in alignment with this view in that it ensures that all segments of our industry have equal access to Oregon's valued apprenticeship training system without respect to how the employer chooses to organize his or her workforce. I might add that some AGC members serve proudly on union apprenticeship trusts and committees, and other AGC members serve just as proudly on open shop apprenticeship trusts and committees. Our goal is to ensure that every worker and employer who wants to avail themselves of these important services are able to do so. To ensure that apprenticeship administration services are available to all our members, the association assumes the arduous and sometimes thankless task of administering apprenticeship programs, not just for AGC members, but for anyone in the industry desiring these services. We currently administer 6 apprenticeship programs registered in Oregon, as well as 2 in Washington, and you can see about that in the brochures that we handed out, with a combined enrollment of about 200 apprentices. Because the rules for starting a new apprenticeship program in Oregon are currently not clear on the issues of access, we initially had difficulty in our attempts to register 2 other programs, a brick masons and a cement finishers apprenticeship program, due to the issues addressed by this bill. But we are now optimistic that with Commissioner Gardner's support, along with members of the State Apprenticeship Council, these programs too will soon be offering state-recognized education and training for workers in these trades. Additionally, we are serving with the Commissioner and other industry representatives, both union and open shop, to address these issues in the spirit of collaboration. We are pleased that this process is in place, and we are looking forward to a positive result. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Jessica, did you have any more to add?
Yeah, we just want to thank you very much for the opportunity to come and talk about apprenticeship again. We know it was in front of you today, and it may or may not appear. We just wanted to, and we appreciate your invitation to come and talk about these issues and share with you why we think it's important that we continue to work on this issue and AGC's commitment to workforce.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Can I have Bob Shiprack and John Molas? Sure, that'd be fine.
Good morning, Chair Brown.
Good morning.
Committee members, I had the opportunity to meet most of you here within the last couple of weeks. It's nice seeing you again. First of all, my name's Ken Pry. I'm a journeyman electrician, first of all. I completed our apprenticeship program many, many years ago. I've been in the industry for over 38 years, and I've been involved with training, apprenticeship training, for the last 30 years. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. We're very proud of our apprenticeship program and the number of people that we have trained in our apprenticeship program. Our program celebrated its 75th anniversary last year, and we look forward to another 75 years of serving the state of Oregon. A couple of issues regarding apprenticeship training. You've already heard a lot of testimony today regarding how training takes place. But basically what happens in apprenticeship is that approximately 90% of the training should take place on the job, and 10% of the training should take place in the classroom, just by the sheer number of hours that you serve in each area. And so we're very concerned about that training that takes place on the job site. Over our, I administer one large program and 2 smaller electrical programs. and our five-year inside program, over the 5 years, we spend approximately $6,000 per year per apprentice, or $30,000 over the course of the apprenticeship program. I wanted to point out a couple of things that from earlier testimony. Number one, when we look at ratio, we're looking at job site specific. Generally how we look at ratio. We want to see, is that apprentice being trained properly on the job? Is there attention to safety? And I'm not aware of any program that does not allow a one-to-one for the first apprentice. Then beyond that, then the ratios change. As a member of the council, what I have seen when industry has presented a compelling argument to alter or change their ratio, the council has responded in a positive way. And so the council is aware of the needs of industry and is trying to work with industry to help develop the future workforce of Oregon. I know in our own case, 20 years ago, we had about 1,800 electricians, trained electricians in our area, in our local union. Today, we have about 3,500. We have done a good job of preparing for the future through training, and we will continue to do so. So, again, I speak to quality, I speak to safety, and do oppose this bill. Thank you.
Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. I didn't know we were going to be talking about my trade this morning so much. I am also an electrician, so my comments are generally based upon the broad issue of apprenticeship here this morning. I won't belabor the electrician stuff. Just a couple points I want to add to Ken's testimony. The apprenticeship committees historically have to type, I call it taking out a crystal ball. You have to try and gauge what the construction economy is going to be doing. It's hard to do, but the contractors, and part of what my job is to try and gauge the needs of the industry so that enough apprentices are put in to the various programs to meet that need. The last thing you want to do, and this happened to us, the electrical industry, I'm painfully aware of it, in the economic collapse of the early 80s, we had just come through a booming economy, had a whole bunch of apprentices not only in the programs, but signed up to go into these programs when the economy collapsed, construction economy anyway, and we lost a lot of people because we couldn't employ them. The thing that you have to remember, as was discussed earlier, the apprentices have to work because the state requires a certain number of hours both in school and on the job training in order to become a journeyman as determined by the Bureau of Labor and under the state laws. So these I call them kids, so a lot of them aren't kids, but these people have got to be employed in order to meet those requirements of the workforce requirements. I wanted to talk a little bit about something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and that's this workforce shortage. I read about this across the country. I subscribe to a lot of things. Obviously very familiar with the Oregon situation. And one of the things that needs to be said is that, I've been on the Employment Advisory Committee for 12 years, just recently was taken off of it. And interestingly enough, you watch these trends just in the construction industry about contractors complaining they can't get people, sheet metal, plumbers, electricians. Yet, our own analysis by the Oregon Employment Department is that the reason they can't get these people is they don't pay them enough. I want to tell you here and now, speaking for the building trades, construction workers work for money. That's why they work. And that's what some of the problems that drive this workforce shortage is simply that certain employers don't want to pay the going wages that are going to attract people to go to work for them. So I think that needs to be understood.
2374 perpetuates, I hate to use the word, cheap labor philosophy of apprenticeship versus what apprenticeship is established for and governed by federal law since the early 30s. The federal law that governs both the Bad and Sac states was put in place to protect the apprentice. And I think we need to step back and remember why that law was passed. It's to protect these people from exploitation. And they're there to learn a trade, not to be there because it sharpens someone's bid or load up a job with people that aren't journeyman quality folks. And the whole effect is to have a qualified workforce. I have two last points I want to add, and I want to tell the committee, Mr. Chair, particularly, I'm in the process of putting together statistics all about apprenticeship because this issue has become politicized, and it really bothers me that our training system is now politicized in a variety of arenas, and I'm putting together statistics. I hope to have it completed within 2 months. I'm going to have it published, bound, distributed to all the legislators, public agencies, etc. The preliminary numbers I got just yesterday, these are from the State Bureau of Labor, that makes me wonder about some of the assertions here. If you took the three major trades, electricians, plumbers, and sheet metal workers, there are more non-union apprentices in those three trades graduate than union. Yet in some of these trades, the market share based on prevailing wage surveys done by the employment department, the market share may be 20, 25, 30%. So I'm wondering where all these people are now. There are a lot of them that have went out. I can tell you from the preliminary data, a lot of these kids are put in the programs. The question that has not been raised here today is how many complete the program. They wash out, they quit, they're tired, they're dissatisfied with the money, whatever. But one of the problems we have in the industry is you can start all these people you want, but the goal is to finish them out. And oftentimes that doesn't happen in some of these programs. I wanted you to be aware of that. The last thing, my last point, I've been doing workers' comp in this building for 22 years. Every statistic I've seen from Oregon OSHA proves that a worker, particularly in construction, in the first 6 months is more likely to be injured than anybody else. That is, I really would like to see the proponents' data on this because it flies in the face of everything I've seen and read on Oregon statistics. With that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is John Mollis. I'm a bricklayer by trade. I started my apprenticeship 27 years ago last month. I'm currently the business manager of Bricklayers Allied Craft Workers Local 1. I'm the chair of our Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee of the Oregon Southwest Washington Mason Trades, JATC, and I'm also a member of the State Apprenticeship Council. Our local has minutes dating back to 1888 that talk about how an apprentice would come before that committee and become indentured to become a bricklayer apprentice. So we've been doing this for a long time. I too would like to testify in opposition to this bill. I won't repeat once again the points that Mr. Bryan and Mr. Shiprack have made. In my time on the State Apprenticeship Council, I believe that the council works very well when industries come forward and say, here's what the employers and the employee representatives think is best for our industry. I think the council has always listened to them very well and reacted appropriately. So I think this bill is putting something in the state law that I don't believe needs to be there. I don't have specific data on safety, but I worked out with the tools for a long time on the wall before I went into the office to do the job that I'm doing now. Our trades work on scaffolds at great heights. There's forklifts that boom material up, and common sense would tell me that in my trade, the trades that I represent, a a one-to-one ratio would result in more job site accidents. I think just common sense would tell you that the more untrained people you have in these dangerous occupations, the higher the chance is to have accidents. So, once again, I am here in opposition to this bill today, and if you have any questions, I'd do my best to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. We've talked a lot today about two-to-one, one-to-one, but the way I read this, and correct me if I'm wrong, this would allow one journeyman to any number of apprentices. And I would like, you know, I don't think any responsible contractors, the majority, if not all, AGC members, open shop or union shop, are going to have an out-of-whack ratio because it would be bad business for one thing. But unfortunately, not everybody out there is a good business person and is concerned about safety or even their product in the end. I would like these gentlemen who have worked on job site to just speak to the potential, you know, calamity that would happen. Imagine if you had one journeyman carpenter putting together wall forms for a 20-foot-high concrete wall and then 10 apprentices helping them. It could go to hell in a handbasket in a heartbeat. So I'm really concerned about that huge gaping hole in this legislation before us. It's more of a comment than anything else. But
Representative Kitts?
I think Representative Schaffler brings up a good point that 1 to 10 would probably not be a good ratio. I would also think that there would be some liability issues there that would probably prohibit the employer from doing such things. The safety argument doesn't get me there because nobody can provide any instance of when the safety has been a factor. Neither side can. One side says it's not, the other side says it is, but nobody gives examples of anything. My bigger concern, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, for walking into the committee. I had a radio interview at 9 o'clock. I was not simply being rude to our testifiers. So I hear this argument, the consistent argument that I've heard throughout this entire hearing is that of cheap labor. The employer wants cheap labor. Folks, they start at $10.52 an hour. So it's a two-part question. Number one, do you think that's cheap labor? You can answer that one.
I'll be happy to answer that.
Okay.
And I'll explain why, Representative Kitts. In construction, you're not a guaranteed 40-hour work week.
Right.
So you suffer periods of unemployment. So you have to take a look at the hourly rate based upon annual earnings. And it could be a significant difference. I also use this analogy. Getting back to my earlier comments about we work for money,
mm-hmm.
Would a person, the best example I can have is you can take somebody that can work in a warehouse, running a forklift, steady employment, versus somebody that's going to make about the same money with no guarantees that they're going to have full employment, that they're not going to suffer long periods of unemployment. And, you know, where are a lot of these people going to go? They go to the warehouse. I mean, it's human nature. So you got to look at those factors, too.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I agree with everything you just said, but I've got to get back to you. I don't classify 1052 as cheap labor, and while most people do work for money, I guess the legislature is an anomaly because we work for the people of Oregon. And I'd be happy to make $10.52 an hour, I promise you that. But the AFL-CIO defines a living wage as $10.63.
Mm-hmm.
So these people are starting out at 11 cents below what the labor authority in this country, I think is a fair thing to say, defines as a living wage. So I'm having a hard time marrying the two of they're looking for cheap labor, but it's what the labor authority
mm-hmm.
in this country is basically defining as a living wage. So I'm wondering if you can help me bridge that gap.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. From one of my signatory employers' perspective, and I can't speak 100% for them, obviously, but when you're looking at a journeyman bricklayer who is roughly at $28 an hour and the apprentice is at $14, that's quite a bit of difference.
The other big difference, I think, would be in the benefits. In our collective bargaining agreement, the apprentice bricklayer makes the exact same hourly benefits as the journeyman bricklayer does from the first hour that he or she begins work on that job. You heard earlier today from some of the proponents that there's lots of variations in the open shop. I know in the masonry industry, I talked to open shop workers, they don't qualify for health insurance for the first 6 months that they work. Then maybe after that they qualify for health insurance for themselves only, and if they want to have coverage for their spouse and their children, they have to take money off of their paycheck. I'm not saying that's the way all of them are. It just varies widely. So if you're looking at a difference between a full journeyman wage and benefit package versus a $10 apprentice that might not have any benefits paid in on them for three to 6 months, that's a pretty huge difference.
I think that helps.
Statistics that Mr. Shiprack will bring forward will show that the large majority of apprentices that drop out of programs, whether union or non-union, do so in the first 6 months of the program.
Which is probably why the employer wouldn't want to pay benefits the first 6 months if they're not going to be a viable contributor to
the program. That's correct. We have a defined benefit pension plan that the employers pay in the first hour. If the person doesn't stick around and become vested, that money just goes into the kitty, so to speak. But it's important for us to have people have benefits from the very start. But I think the majority of apprentices do drop out because they get out on a day like today where it's raining and it's unpleasant conditions, and they say, I don't want to do this. And going back to what Bob was talking about, the hours, our pension plan, every year our valuation, the average hours worked for everyone, bounces somewhere between 1,350 and 1,450 hours a year. So you've got to make decent wages per hour in order to have enough yearly to make a good income.
Thank you.
Good finish off there.
We talk about living. Yeah, there's folks in third world nation right here in America that are living. They're living in a shack. They're making a lot less than $10 an hour. I know we're getting off the core of this bill here, sir, but I can't help but respond to my good colleague here. I had the happy, wonderful, joyful experience of being a hod carrier for about 8 or 9 months, and I alluded to screaming carpenters earlier. I'd never done it before. And before it was done, I could keep five bricklayers going all day long. Now, if you can find somebody out there that's going to do it for $10 an hour, no benefits, God bless them, but you know what? They ain't going to find them. They ain't going to stay, and I don't blame them because it is absolutely arduous labor. When our daughter was born, you got me going here, Derek, and I'm not going to shut up. When our daughter was born, I was in the union, and my wife is a doctor of dentistry, so we weren't starving to death, and we ain't now, obviously. But and my wife and I have been making, both of us had each had a job paying $10 an hour each. My wife had a cesarean. We were in the hospital for 3 days, all three of us. We would have been bankrupt. We never, ever would have been able to pay that bill. So I just this living wage thing, and I think if you brought the if we pushed the authority of labor up here and asked what they felt about this bill, I'm confident the authority of labor in America would oppose it. I don't know if they're going to testify or not, but I'm glad to see you do recognize AFL-CIO as an authority in labor here in America. But $10 an hour, I argue it, you might be able to live on it, but it ain't much of a living.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's obvious that this is starting to get a little far afield here. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the study that Representative Kitts is referencing is one I'm pretty familiar with, and I just wanted to clarify that if that's the Northwest Jobs study that Alan Ippolito did a few years back, it's that this is a living wage, allows somebody not to have a subsidy, and it's for a single person as well. So I think you also need to think about when we're talking about family wages, providing for children, it's a whole different story.
Thank you.
So Chairman, could I make one last comment?
Certainly.
Just to frame this issue for the committee.
How come it's the last word?
Well,
what he has to say is...
it comes up with a question that was asked about you could have potentially five apprentices and one journeyman, which under the bill you could. The reason you have more journeymen to apprentices is that the apprentice has to learn different tasks. When I was running work and I had an apprentice on the job, maybe I had a couple and I had, you know, 8 or 9 journeymen. I would move those apprentices around the journeymen so that they were, if one guy was doing the high voltage terminations, I put him over there. If there was some trick pipe mending, put him over there, switch gear terminations, things like that. So you move these kids around. Under the law, again, that we have to follow, these apprentices have to fill out what are known as progress reports. They have to report what they've been learning out in the field and send it into the committee, which is then filed with the Bureau of Labor, so that we are ensuring that they are learning something. You get 5 of them out there, and I'll tell you what will happen. You're going to have one guy that's going to be the ditch digger. One guy's the guy that's going to mount the boxes. One guy's going to be the guy that drills, and another guy's going to be the pulls the wire. That's what you're going to end up with because they're not going to learn the trade.
Thank you. Just a closing comment, I think that Bob and I are probably the only ones at the panel and with the committee up here that have been here through the last regular session and through 5 special sessions, and I'll tell you, it's a great deal more pleasant to be talking about how to fill jobs and how to pay the unemployment benefits, and I'm glad to see we've made that clear. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Last panel, we'll have Ed Glad and Bill Cluding.
Good morning. My name is Ed Glad. I'm with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters here in Oregon, and we represent carpenters. The Pacific Northwest is a 5-state regional council that extends to Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. We represent a lot of carpenters who have both been through apprenticeship and who have not been through apprenticeship. And I wanted to, since this discussion has gone to, pretty far afield, I wanted to acknowledge one thing, is that there's a lot of people in the room here from a lot of different parts of our industry, and we're all on our best behavior, which is kind of fun to have them in the room to talk civilly about something that most of us feel very passionately about. But just to indulge me for a minute, there was a passing of a man who was a apprentice in the apprenticeship, the carpenter's apprenticeship last weekend. His name was Bruce Cummings. He was an AGC contractor at the end of his career. He started as an apprentice, became a journeyman, eventually became a contractor, and was one of the most staunchest proponents of apprenticeship in the carpenter sector of our industry. And it is a sad day to have to acknowledge that he has gone on to work with carpenters at a much greater level than he had here in this life. This bill represents issues, very many issues, with regards to the dynamic of the training of individual people who start out not knowing anything about the craft that they're getting into to becoming journeymen. The word journeyman has to do with an old term that when somebody finished their apprenticeship period, they were required to move to a different area, perhaps a different state, but certainly to other contractors, to start their journey to be exposed to other techniques and other approaches to doing the same craft. In the construction industry, and particularly the carpenter field, there are all sorts of functions that we perform, and it is possible to perform the same functions with different techniques and certainly different attitudes. The craftsman, in the end, is exposed to the various journeymen that they work around in order to be able to become a full craftsman and represent themselves as the person who can produce so that the contractor is interested in hiring them so that they can continue to make money as contractors. to water down that relationship, to increase the number of apprentices that the journeyman is responsible to supervise at any given time, is dangerous because it disrupts the ability for the individual craftsman to pass on the quality of workmanship that is necessary to be able to have that production level that the contractor is expecting, so that that person will have a career. I think that Bob's point that we don't work year-round unless we are extraordinarily talented or we have an uncle or a father that owns the company, that we oftentimes find ourselves as craftsmen working 6 or 8 months of the year and waiting until the weather passes so that construction can start anew in the spring. That is an impact on the industry and on the individuals who participate in this industry. Certainly, the carpenters believe the statistics are showing up saying that we are going to be facing a workforce shortage in the near future. There are a lot of dynamics that cause that, including the modern age where people are retiring from their careers at 55 and leaving craft work much earlier than at one time when they would work sometimes till their 70s. If in fact we are going to be facing that shortage, the requirement is not the requirement for us as a society and as an industry is not to increase the number of apprentices by forcing apprentices upon journeymen, but by requiring that contractors employ apprentices at a rate that is commensurate with the need of having future workforce out there. By that I mean that we should be asking or requiring that contractors on all of their jobs have apprentices at each of the levels of development on their jobs, and not be looking to having cheap labor in the crunch, but in effect saying, if you're going to be working, you're going to have these apprentices as well as the journeymen to get it done. I appreciate once again you're giving us the opportunity to be on our best behavior in this room, and that this discussion obviously is beginning with lots of different elements of this industry, and that we should continue this discussion for a long period of time to actually see that our workforce continues and that our crafts are preserved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. And Bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Committee, for the record, my name is Bill Cluding. I represent the Western Council of Industrial Workers in the state of Oregon. All my people work in mill complexes of one type or another. We're back to the electrician side of it again. The industrial electrician is in a unique little world. I've had my license since 1970. I picked up my supervisor's license 7 years ago. Not 1 year after I had my German license did not have an apprentice with me. I can state I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. In our business, the mill has to run. We don't have the luxury sometimes of shutting down the whole mill complex. The panel next to us might be hot. It will be hot. The panel we're working in might be hot. Sometimes it has to be hot. Our test probes, if you've ever looked at a test probe, isn't more than about that long. You heard a statement where the difference between high voltage and low voltage was 110 volts. A lot of people in the state's been killed with 109 and less. That's low voltage. You've heard the numbers of the job shortages. My only statement to that is it sounds like we have to move quickly, but I urge this committee to move carefully. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Don't see any. Thank you both, gentlemen. I appreciate the testimony. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on 2374? Seeing none, I want to thank the committee for their indulgence. We've been listening to this now for an hour and a half. Very good conversation, and I certainly want to thank those in the audience that have testified. It's the importance of having a well-trained and well-paid workforce in Oregon is paramount, and I appreciate you people coming forward to your testimony. Thank you again. And with that, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2374 and open the hearing on House Bill 3440, Representative Shoffler. You can do it right from there if you like.
Yeah, and you know,
Janet, can you give us a rundown quickly on the bill?
Mr. Chair, on House Bill 3440, the issues may sound familiar because you already heard House Bill 2463. This is a identical bill to House Bill 2463 with a different relating point.
That's exactly right.
The measure exempts unemployment benefits from state personal income tax. It would apply to unemployment benefits that are paid after January 1st, 2006, and for which an exemption is claimed for beginning in that year. Mr. Chair, the background has not changed, and Representative Shoffler is here. There are also representatives from the Employment Department. And just for the record, if anyone is looking at this record in the future, they should refer to the February 28th hearing on the Committee on House Bill 2463, because that's where a lot of the need was established. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I did give you all the new bill with a new relating clause. It's the exact same bill. And then I also have on there dash one amendment. We can fill in the blank. And I apologize. I thought, oh, it is on the back of this. On the back, you can see the breakdown of if we have a threshold that would trigger this. If it was everything below 30,000 joined a single return, it would cost us, according to this, $25.5 million in the next 2 years. '05, '06, '06, '07. Then we knock it down to 20,000. You can see it's far less. But if you look at that chart on the other side of that page, we'd still reach over 60,000 low-income workers, which it would be, you know, they wouldn't get a bill at the end of the year for income tax due to on their unemployment insurance. And once more, I just want to, this will help these folks go put their money in stocks and bonds, and they spend all the money. This is all going to be a direct shot in the arm to the economy. It's going to help them in their houses and their homes to provide for themselves. And I just urge us to do it. If we want to fill in that blank today, that's fine, Mr. Chair. Or if you want to just leave it blank and pass it on to Ways and Means and let them fill it in with all their wisdom, I'd be happy with either one you want, either way you want to go on that.
Excuse me,
Revenue, not Ways and Means.
Does it have a subsequent referral to Revenue then?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Representative. Is the Employment Department?
Yes, sir.
Tamara, please.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department, and I have the manager of UI Programs and Methods with me here, Susan Johnson, from the department as well. So, did you have a question?
Any questions? Everybody just looks at me if it's there. So.
Thanks for coming.
I can just provide you with some real quick background with respect to...
Some comments, please.
This will not have any... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this will not have a fiscal impact on the Employment Department with respect to staffing or anything, because it just involves a minor tweaking of a program in one of our mainframes to stop withholding, and we would stop withholding for certain individuals, depending on what income level you would want us to do that at. So it would just take some programming to do that. It is within the state's purview to decide whether to tax unemployment insurance benefits. These benefits will still be taxable at the federal level. Right now, a person doesn't have to have the money withheld from their unemployment insurance check if they don't want. It's a complete voluntary requirement at this time. If they want it withheld, they can ask for it. If they don't want it withheld, it doesn't have to be withheld, but they do have to pay taxes on their benefits at the end of the year.
Okay, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I'm just curious, and it has nothing to do with this bill, but what is unemployment, the maximum? I don't have a clue.
Unemployment insurance is different in every state. We have a maximum benefit amount in the state of Oregon of $419 a week, a minimum of $98 a week. And it's designed basically on a formula to be a certain percentage replacement of your wages. In Oregon, it's designed to replace up to a maximum of 64% of your wages from your previous, from your base year wages. But again, it's a capped at 419, and then there's a minimum of 98.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, folks. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 3440? Okay. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3440 and open a work session on House Bill 3440.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into. Is that how you want to do it?
Yeah. Do you want to fill some blanks in there?
Yeah. Would you like to fill in a number or leave?
I would. If this bill goes on to revenue, I would. If we do not fill those blanks in, I would suggest that it be forward without recommendation as to.
Well, I'm open for suggestions. Any number? Anybody have?
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a quick question. If we, in fact, send this to revenue with the blanks open, without recommendation, can we require of revenue to send it back to this committee once they've plugged in the number for approval?
I don't think so.
That's a lot of work.
They don't listen to what I tell them. They do what they ask.
Well, Mr. Chair,
have you
finished representing? No, not quite yet. But I appreciate your patience with me, Representative Schaffler, as you've shown all day long. Then I would suggest the committee either postpone this to a date certain and make a recommendation to send a revenue so that we can, in fact, send this to revenue with a due pass recommendation. But I would hate to see the committee just arbitrarily look at this for 2 seconds, plug in a date, and send it down there. So I would move we postpone this bill to a date certain, and that date being the next committee meeting.
Okay, Representative.
Which is not a debatable motion.
I've never had to deal with this one yet, so I don't know whether it's debatable or not. Representative Kitts moves that we postpone the decision on House Bill 3440 until the. Yeah, and we haven't adopted amendments until the next meeting, which would be.
Wednesday.
Okay, Wednesday next. Actually, Representative Kitts, Monday. Would the no to Wednesday?
Wednesday?
Yes.
Yes.
That would be better. Is that fine? All right. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's postponed, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3440. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2670. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2670 is introduced by the committee at the request of the Oregon Petroleum Association and would provide that motor vehicle fuel dealers, both dealers of gasoline and aircraft fuel, may retain 2% of the amount of the state gas tax they collect to cover their cost of collection. Mr. Chair, the background lists the current fuel taxes in the first paragraph and then about the fourth paragraph lists the agencies that would be affected and the funds that would be affected with reduction. The dealers are currently reimbursed for their cost of collection, are not reimbursed for their cost of collection, and with the rise of the use of credit cards, they face an out-of-pocket charge, and that is the reason, that is my understanding for the bill. Mr. Chair, this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Can I have Paul remain, please?
I'm bringing my bodyguard with me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association.
and I brought Jay Balding, who's a dealer in the area, to answer questions. But let me kind of go over the reason why we wanted this bill and the reason why you're probably not going to pass the bill out today, and we'll make your life a lot easier. So we'll go with that. Number one, the reason why we wanted this bill is simply a matter of fairness. Basically, what happens is when we collect diesel tax money for you, we are your collection agent, basically, we deduct a 4% as a handling fee for the cost of collection. In other states, Nevada, Idaho, Colorado, to some degree in Washington State, more for shrinkage in Washington State, they deduct, when they collect gasoline taxes for the state, the dealers deduct a percentage collection fee. We have no collection fee in the state of Oregon for doing this. Now, we understand and we accept the fact that as business people, if you want to tax a particular industry or people who use that particular industry, because it's the people out there who pay the tax, we realize that we, as business people, will accept the cost of that collection. We do that for you. We are really your agents. You're actually collecting it from all the individuals out there who use the gas, and we're your agents to go collect that for you, and we do that. The problem is that in our business, we have credit card use. When you first put in the gas tax, there was no credit card. You just paid cash. Then it went to company credit cards, where you have a situation where there was no fee, really, for us in that situation. But nowadays, over the last, say, 10 to 15 years, you have more and more use, and you'll see it with your own personal use. You're not using your Union 76 card or Chevron card. You use your MasterCard or Visa. And the reason you do that is because you like those airline miles or other bonus miles that you get. Well, the problem with that is we have to pay a fee to that credit card company for your use of the card and our acceptance of the card. And that fee tends to be between, say, 2.3% up to, say, 3%. So in a way to offset that fee, which is, it's literally like saying to us, not only will you have to do the collection for us, which we do, but you're going to have to pay a 2 to 3% fee to be our unemployed or uncompensated employee. That's really a good deal for us. So what we're asking for is some kind of relief on that. There are different ways you could go about doing it. One of them is you could direct the credit card companies through legislation to not charge a fee on the collection of taxes, the tax portion of any bill. That would be an acceptable way to do it that wouldn't come out of the fund. Behind me sit a whole bunch of people who get money from the fund, cities, contractors who work on roads, things like that. And as with anything, anytime you go after a particular fund and you are saying put less money into the fund, the ones who get money out of those funds don't like it, not happy about it. We also understand in this day and age, when you're not raising that amount in the fund, that it does become a tougher sell, and we understand political reality here. But you all also have to understand political reality. We're not opposed to raising the gas tax. We really don't care that much about raising the gas tax. We would not oppose raising the gas tax if that's something you wanted to do. We would want our fee. We would want to possibly redirect some of the stuff, but we're one of the unique industries where, because it's pretty much an essential product, it's not going to really affect sales as long as we keep it competitive with Washington State and our other neighbors. So we're not opposed to that. But what we do want you to understand is we are literally having to pay out of our pockets 2 to 3% to collect this for you. And it's something we can't just turn around and charge the consumer, because you may look at high gas prices out there and say, ooh, they must be making a fortune. But that's when we lose money. We can't keep up. We can't raise our price fast enough, really, to keep up with the wholesale margins that keep shrinking. We can't expand. We lose money trying to remain somewhat competitive, trying to at least not be out there gouging the public for high gas prices. But at some point, you need to deal with this problem. But we do understand political reality. I want Jay to talk to you a little bit about what it is for an individual dealer, and then we'll let all the others, maybe if they know that this bill probably is going to get more of a directive to work on a solution and maybe come back at some point, that the testimony will shorten up and you'll have time for the other bills. But Jay, go ahead.
Like you said, I'm Jay Baldwin, and I didn't know that he needed a meaty guy to be his bodyguard in here today. This issue is no different than any other relationship in business. What's fair for you is fair for us. And when this deal was done, it was more before the credit card era came about. And as gas prices continue to rise, the burden on dealers and jobbers in the state of Oregon grows. The credit card percentage fee at $1.70 a gallon is significantly less than at $2.35 a gallon. And as you slowly see gas stations boarded up and going away little by little, and big box people coming in, that's without the competition, it's less healthy for people. So it's just a basic matter of mathematics where everybody is doing credit cards. My four sites alone where we employ 71 people, I checked. My credit card fees last month alone, just to do this, were about $1,200 last month, which is a pretty significant number for me, in addition to having to pay bookkeepers and that type of thing, which is fine with the 4% that we get back from the diesel thing. But it's just become a burden through no fault of our own that the industry has changed towards credit. And there's really no end in sight that we see. And the 2% that we are asking for is a very conservative number, as most credit cards transactions come closer to 3%.
Mr. Chair, there are a couple of things. One is we didn't really mean to include aviation fuel, and I realize folks are going to talk about that, but we have no intent of including aviation fuel. Representative Gilman, you can relax now. But it's a matter of fairness. We will be more than happy to work with the affected people out there. I don't think anybody disagrees that being asked to collect something is one thing, but being asked to sort of pay a fee to get no money to collect is not real. Good thing, not a real good thing. We'll work with the affected people and hopefully come back to you with something that maybe this session, it may not be this session given the dollar situation, but come back to you with something that works and gets us to the point where we really should be, which is we'll do the collection, but we don't want to have to pay to collect.
Do you have any idea what the bottom line figure is, what this would... how many dollars does that impact the Highway Trust Fund?
Mr. Chair, I've been told by a little bird who works for the Department of Transportation that the fiscal impact will be approximately, this next biennium, approximately $15 to $18 million. Now, realizing that's a fairly sizable chunk, you should also understand that that's how much that comes out of our pocket, or approximately how much that comes out of our pocket. So, yes, it is a sizable chunk. We just feel it's a better sizable chunk coming out of one pocket than our pocket. And the next biennium, I believe, is projected to be a higher amount. Again, it's 2% of the total gas tax that's collected. So, again, you collect about $400 million in that range. So, it's something you can kind of figure out annually. It comes to about $7.5 million based on last year's figures annually.
So. And so if this bill was to pass, then I could expect that we would have $15 to $18 million lower fuel price in the next biennium then?
Mr. Chair, you can expect anything you want.
Representative Kitts.
Paul, I don't know if you know the number or not. If you don't, I'm sure some of the other testifiers that are coming after you will. Do you know what the transportation package that we passed out in 03, what the total dollar amount on that package was?
$2.5 billion.
$2.5 billion?
I'm a ventriloquist.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, Mr. Romaine, it's very generous of you to just come up and say that you don't oppose raising the gas tax. And I think the political, and I know you're well aware, the political possibility of that happening is zero. So I think it's about as likely as the beer tax getting raised. Anyway,
I'll drink to that.
But the gas tax is in the Constitution. Are you going to have any constitutional issues with this? And I have a follow-up question, too.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't believe we would.
Okay. But, and then my next question, Mr. Chair. We've talked about this in the hall. Outside of this, are you all looking at things that will help stabilize the price of gas here in Oregon? Are things we could do to help, you know, our energy problems and challenges here in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm glad you asked that question, and sorry, Bill, but this may take a little while. Yes, we have been looking at numerous ways. It's very troubling to us because we're the point people on it. We're the ones who get yelled at when we put up $2.35 on the board that you drive by and see. But we're just trying to make a living and keep the station open. So, yes, we are trying. There are two different ways that we've thought of, and we think that discussion should be started, and we've had conversations with the chair about possibly, you know, getting some conversation going. One of them, the most obvious thing, but frankly an interesting idea, is building a refinery in the state of Oregon, either in the Astoria region or the Coos Bay region. The second thing that really came up, and again on the refinery deal, it's something that really does need to be explored. Nothing is here in this state, and frankly a lot of stuff is being refined offshore now, and it would help to stabilize things here. The other thing that came up at a meeting we had when we were trying to figure out, is there something simpler? Because again, whenever you mention the word refinery, people kind of get nervous, although we believe that most of the environmental concerns that one would have had 30 years ago when about the last refinery was built really don't exist today with today's technology. But the other thing is to look at storage in the state. There's a huge amount of diesel and gasoline storage facilities available in the state that are basically empty, and that we might be able to actually work some situation where we get some kind of incentives, if you would, to in effect have our own strategic reserve within the state, bring in gas, bring in diesel, have it there to stabilize. Your bigger problem, frankly, from a gas supply situation, is you have so many different boutique fuels out there that it's difficult to actually pull fuel from one region to another. When California, just recently when the diesel prices went flying up, you could pull diesel for about 30 cents a gallon cheaper in California. We couldn't use it up here. So, I mean, maybe if you have two or three different fuel blends, that's fine, but when you've got so many different fuel blends out there, you know, you really can't just swap supplies around. So,
follow up.
Very briefly, the Astoria site would be for your conventional, a crude refinery. But are you all looking into like biofuel, biodiesel refineries, which could be put in a place that is not so environmentally sensitive, where you wouldn't get that kind of negative knee-jerk reaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we distribute biodiesel, biofuels. There's a number of bills out there concerning biofuels and also ethanol. Those issues are fairly new right now, and there's a lot of different pros and cons to all that stuff. And again, we distribute the stuff. We use ethanol. We mix it. We actually voluntarily, whether there's a mandate or not, we mix it when appropriate in the gas. But those issues really have to be explored. I'll give you just one for example. There's a draft report coming out of California basically on ethanol, which actually says that ethanol actually puts more pollutants into the atmosphere than not having ethanol. And, you know, it's there's a lot of science on that stuff now that's just coming out because it is new. So a lot of these things that may become the new elixir aren't quite there yet. We need to talk about them. We don't want you mandating anything in statute that will lock us into something that you'll have to unmandate 2 years down the line. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Representative Gilman.
Paul, I understand that this bill is just a vehicle to get the conversation started, but I do have a concern. The bill provides for 2% of all your tax collected. If a station is only accepting cash, that is quite a benefit to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, yes, and that was actually done intentionally, not to make them wealthy. It was just easier to administer. What we did was, rather than saying, because the credit card fee really approaches 3%, rather than saying 3% of just the credit card amount or the gas tax portion of the credit card, where your bookkeeping and the state's bookkeeping would be a mess, what we decided to say is, all right, we're going to go to 2% of everything, and that will probably approximate. And yes, a station that does all credit card stuff is not going to make out as well. A station that does only cash, which are becoming fewer and fewer, by the way, will do a lot better. But that's sort of one of those things that, for convenience purposes, maybe that outweighs, if I had a gas station that just took cash and was doing this, maybe it would be a benefit to me. That's not our intent. We represent all of them. And
if I may, Mr. Gilman, currently, at least at my stations, it's 78% of all customers use credit cards. And even the percentage with diesel is even higher, as many, many diesel customers are on national fleet accounts of one kind or another, Voyager, Ride Express, those type of things. So I would argue with you the percentage is even greater with diesel credit card usage.
Representative Holding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I've got a question. Maybe you can take me back to Fuel 101. Is there something that prevents the dealers from just raising their price? You know, I hate to even think of that, but raising their price per gallon to cover these costs instead of trying to get a reimbursement off from the tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, no. But again, what we get into is, in this day and age of trying to raise your price, it's going up fast enough with just trying to keep up your margin with the wholesale price increase that you're paying. Adding that additional thing on is, yeah, you could do it, but in this competitive environment, your push is to try and drive it down. So, yes, you can. Yes, we do. We try and do it as much as possible. We'd like to get out of that. And since we're doing your collection for you, we thought it might be a nice gesture to at least cover our costs of a collection.
I think the answer to that question, if you've ever been in the retail business, yes, there is something that prevents you from raising your price, and it's called the market.
Right. Yeah.
Representative Kitts.
Two things. Are you defining ATM cards as credit cards also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, we haven't defined anything here. Basically, what we're saying is anything for our purposes, we didn't try to break it out in the statute. We just said 2% of everything. So for statutory purposes, it's irrelevant. But any card that we would pay a fee on to have you use, we would consider to be, that's the thing we're trying to get reimbursement for. And you do pay, I believe, fees on the debit.
We do pay debit card fees, and they are less than 2%, slightly, usually between 1.25 and 1.75 with the transaction fee. However, in the state of Oregon, that savings isn't realized with many customers or us. Since it's not a self-serve state, very few people are willing to give you their PIN number that is required at the CRINs, at the point of purchase, to take advantage of that.
Follow up. If I use my ATM card, I have one of two options. I can use my ATM card as a credit card.
Yes.
It still comes out of my bank account, which would require me not to punch in a PIN number, or I can use it as an actual debit card, which deducts it straight out of my account, as does the credit. The difference being the ATM portion goes directly out, or excuse me, the debit portion goes directly out. The if I run it as a credit card, it takes about 2 days for it to process. Are you charged differently?
Yes.
Depending on how I use my card?
If it's run as a credit card, it's just a standard Visa, MasterCard, whatever, and the fee is 2.5 to 2.75%. So it's a significant number. But again, it's really inconsequential in Oregon because, in my experience, no one has ever been willing to give their PIN number. Card.
But also, I for that purpose, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. For that purpose, Oregon is a self-serve state.
No.
Or not, excuse me, it's not a self-serve state. I understand.
Hey, good Lord, I'm going to have
that different parent. I'm going to have every my phone.
You know, right now, where are you going, kid?
Parent, you want to go there again?
I'm not going there again.
I'm done talking.
We can bring Randy Miller back.
Break those speed limits.
Is there any other questions? I don't see. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Could I have Bob Hidley and Mike Marsh? And we'll settle for those two.
But most of the charges are limits credit.
Those are 78% on credit card. No.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Bob Hidley, the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. We use the revenues from the fuel tax to operate our department and also for airport construction projects and really get a lot more bang out of the money we get for matching funds for FAA grants. So if this legislation was passed the way it's worded right now, we would have a roughly $98,000 every 2 years less money to use for airport construction projects and federal grants. Also, about 72% of the fuel that we receive tax revenue from is from jet fuel, and the vast majority of that is for airlines. They don't pay by credit card. They pay pretty much by purchase orders. So we're looking, in our case, credit card fees would only be about a quarter of the fuel, the avgas, that's used by the small, privately owned piston airplanes. So we would request that this bill be amended so that aviation gasoline and jet fuel be removed from the legislation. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mike.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. The members have our testimony. I'll just summarize a couple points. The first is that the amount is $12.2 million per year. This is the total amount of impact on the highway fund, and that's not just highway projects. It also includes aviation, as we've indicated. It may come out of the bill. But in addition, it relates to snowmobiles, all-terrain vehicles, and boats. So all those elements and the programs supported by that would be impacted. And the amount would be approximately the same as half a cent of the gas tax in terms of the amount of reduction. So it's a significant amount. Secondly, for ODOT alone, looking at the impact, is about $7.3 million per year. Looking at the four-year period of the State Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP, this means about $29 million, a little more than $29 million worth of impact on current projects that are planned for the STIP. So again, a significant impact. With the advent of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, or OTIA, there is a significant economic development role for the money that comes into ODOT and are used for construction projects by cities, counties, and the state. And the highway construction done by in that work is done by private sector contractors. And the amount of money that goes into that, looking at on a ratio of $1 million to 18 jobs, means that we're sustaining a lot of jobs with those investments. So, Mr. Chair, just wanted to indicate that this would require a reduction in revenue, a reduction in actual projects that are planned within the four-year STIP that's coming up. And we're open to any questions.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Could I have Willie Tiffany and Art Slack, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and I'll be real brief. Mr. Romaine is correct. Our issue with the bill is the impact on the Highway Trust Fund. There will be a reduction to the allocation, and your own legislative fiscal office has estimated the gap between the current needs just to maintain the current level of service for cities in terms of maintenance in the next biennium, and the actual funding available at $376 million. So any reduction is a major concern for us. But we do understand the problem, and we would be very, very pleased to work with Mr. Romaine and his clients on the situation, and hopefully we can come up with an equitable solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I haven't seen you this year.
Well, if you were in transportation, you'd see me, and if you were in land use, you'd see me too quite often, as Representative Gilman knows. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And as you can imagine, our concern, too, is with the revenue that's in the Highway Trust Fund at this point. Our understanding is that the proposal at this point would have an impact on counties of approximately $3 million a year. This is, you might say, well, $3 million isn't too much, but I can tell you it's a sizable amount of money for the county road programs and our responsibility for maintaining and preserving the county road system. And let me just add one point that I know some of you are aware of. We are currently in Washington, D.C., dealing with the reauthorization of the Forest Safety Net. The Forest Safety Net at this point brings approximately $95 million a year to counties for their road maintenance program or road program. If we lose that, or it's substantially reduced, the amount of money that counties have to maintain county roads will be greatly affected. So $3 million at this point in time is an extremely significant amount of money. We don't know what's going to happen with reauthorization at this point, but with the competition in Washington, D.C., with the balance of payments, with a war going on and other things, we hear sometimes some good words coming out of Washington, D.C. with regard to that, and sometimes some not so good words going on. So this is a significant, potentially a significant impact on the county road program, and we just want to bring that to your attention, and would be willing to also work on this with others.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Could I have Jessica Adamson, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Jessica Harris Adams, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And as has been indicated, we are a user of the system. We do benefit from the Highway Trust Fund, but we also, as contractors that build the system, feel though we are stewards of the system, we know better than anyone else the cost of not maintaining and preserving our highways. You can pay us now, or you can pay us later. A dollar of deferred maintenance equals $5 in reconstruction costs later. The OTIA 3 program for replacement of bridges is an awful lot more expensive than it would have been to maintain those bridges all the way along. So as we look at the reduction of $12.2 million a year in road maintenance, it's quite a bit significant in not maintaining those roads, not doing the potholes and the crack seal and all of those projects that are important to maintain the system now, as opposed to ignoring that investment and paying for it later. So it is important. AGC, as an entity, is more than happy to work with Paul and others to try and resolve his issue. We can appreciate that problem. On the other hand, those dealers do have choices. It is a business decision on their part to use credit cards. It is a decision that they make, and there is price elasticity to choose to recover that or not. We appreciate their problem. Again, we're more than happy to work with them to solve that problem. But I do think as a broader public policy issue, reducing the gas tax by creating this 2% cost recovery it will cost the taxpayers and the legislature more in the long run than it helps to resolve an issue in the short run. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who'd like to testify on House Bill 2670? None. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2670 and open the hearing on 2056. Janet, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2056 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The bill, as a reminder, does have a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It establishes a one-time non-refundable initial application fee of $400 for Oregon Liquor Control Commission licenses, in addition to the current license fees in statute. It allows a waiver of the new fee by the commission, and the bill also changes the renewal period for licenses from 1 to 2 years, and in order to cover the longer period, it doubles the license fee costs. And those license fees are listed in the statute, I think, on the second page of the bill. And finally, the bill expands eligibility for temporary letter of authority privileges to any licensee and extends the period of authority from 90 to 180 days. Again, Mr. Chair, you can see the license fees in the bill, and they are increased, and in addition, the $400 new application fee. The agency is here to explain the bill and would be able to tell you its fiscal impact. But again, the bill has a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Thanks.
John Steubenbaugh. Is that correct, Steubenbaugh?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
I don't know. Steubenbaugh's tough enough for me.
I'm glad you're back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. My name is John Steubenbaugh. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The bill before you comes to you pre-session filed at the request of OLCC, and as the administrator has explained, the bill addresses state liquor licensing statute in three areas: multi-year liquor licenses, initial filing fee, and expansion of temporary letter of authority. And I could very briefly address each of the three areas, and I'm happy to respond to questions. The multi-year liquor license concept would certainly bring administrative and time and cost savings both to the state and to liquor license holders. Under this proposal, the current statutory provision of requiring liquor license to be renewed each year would allow for a two-year liquor license renewal period. This part of the provision also would allow for the current cost to be collected once every 2 years rather than every year. The second provision in House Bill 2056 is the $400 initial filing fee, which, as the administrator said, is a new fee in statute. The idea behind this fee is to provide for more timely liquor licensing processing for an initial liquor license application. As you can imagine, the first time the OLCC processes a liquor license is the most time intensive for the agency, because we do a thorough background check of the liquor license applicant to ensure that the applicant meets statutory requirements for a liquor license. So what we're looking at with the $400 fee is a way for the agency to recoup staff losses incurred in 02 and 03 and to be able to process initial liquor licenses in a timely manner. What we have today, especially in the Metro Portland areas, is an initial liquor license application taking up to 9,100 days to process, because we simply don't have the staff to keep up with the number of applications we've received. So in effect, what this becomes is a calculation for the liquor license applicant. Is the $400 initial fee worth 30, 45 days, quicker time in getting that liquor license processed. The third provision, then, under House Bill 2056, is an expansion of what's in current statute called then a temporary letter of authority. A temporary letter of authority allows certain liquor license applicants to begin serving alcohol while their liquor license application is being processed. What does this mean? This means that liquor licenses that are simply changing ownership or a new off-premise liquor license. An off-premise license is a grocery store or a convenience store, a liquor license that sells beer or wine to go. Those two types of applicants today can be granted a temporary letter of authority. Other types of liquor license applications, like a bar or a restaurant, for example, under current statute are not allowed a temporary letter of authority. What the proposed legislation would do is simply level the playing field and say any type of liquor license applicant can be granted a temporary letter of authority by the OLCC. And with that, I'd be happy to address questions.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Mr. Stephen Ball, would you want to discuss the proposed amendments with us today or not?
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Our legal staff has talked about suggesting maybe we introduce them first and then bring it back up to talk.
We're not going to do a work session on this today.
All right. Well, then, don't worry about
this. I got a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Kitts.
Thank you. John, I hope this wasn't addressed while I was out in the hall.
Yep.
It was. It's a $400 fee, brand new fee on top of everything. Just wondering how 400 is the magic number and why it's not 200 or 100 or even make it consistent with the four-hour versus the all-day application fee of $50. So can you answer that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, thank you for the question. This discussion actually reaches back into the previous legislative session, the 03 legislative session. This has been an ongoing discussion with a number of the interested parties to this issue. We've arrived, really, I think, at a consensus number at 400 after much discussion. Really, what this would do is to provide resources for an appropriate staffing level at OLCC so that we can move our initial liquor license application timeline down to the 45-day range. Prior to staffing cuts experienced by the agency in 02 and 03, we were at 45 days or less from new liquor license application. We simply can't get there today, especially in the Metro Portland area where we have the majority of our new liquor license applications today. So what we'd like to get to is to, again, be able to process those applications in a timely manner so that we can get folks into business quicker than we can get them into business today.
Follow-up, if I might?
Yes.
Thank you. I think that answers my question to a certain degree. Can you tell me, first of all, how many staff you want to add is question one. Question two, how many people, restaurants, that would this fee affect on an annual basis by your estimates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, as to the second question first, how many would it affect on an annual basis? Given recent years' numbers, probably in the 1,200-1,500 range. Mm-hmm.
1,200-1,500 new applicants?
Applicants.
Okay. Mm-hmm. On an annual or?
Yes.
Okay.
And as to the second, this position would add a total of 6 FTE.
Follow up?
Yes.
At what staffing, what's the starting, what do you call it? I guess salary, but it's the range?
True. Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, the four of those FTE would be what we call liquor license investigators. These are the folks who work directly with the liquor license applicants. Those are salary range 24 folks, and all these positions we would project to start at step two of the range. Another of these six would be a manager position, which is a manager C level. That's salary range 28. Again, starting step two by our projections. And finally, an office specialist 2, salary range 15.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I share my colleague's concern, but now the discussions you've had are with the industry, with the people that are going to be paying this, and they've all come to consensus and said, this is good for our business, get us in business, get us making money, rather than some bureaucracy dragging their feet and making it so they can't open the doors and do business and start making money, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes. It's my understanding that the parties to this discussion are in agreement as to the numbers in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Steubenbaum, didn't we, when we first discussed this, weren't we talking about two full-time employees?
Mr. Chair, I believe that was a different bill.
Oh, okay. They're all running together.
It's all those booze bills.
Was that the one to hire the two people to fast track? Wasn't it something like that? I thought it was the same bill.
That's for the temporary.
You were going to hire two people to get licenses procedure done substantially quicker.
I think it was for your temporary. The 25 to 50.
No, that would. I'm afraid, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'm afraid I'm not. I'm not tracking on the bill that you're asking me about here.
I can get back with you on that because I do remember okay. Two employees, not six. Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Bill Perry and Bill Linden, please.
Now that's where I get in trouble for my questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs. On the bill itself, 2056, obviously the biggest issue for us as retailers is a temporary license. There are many times a retailer has to set up his establishment and start the process for inspections and background checks, and they'll sit there unopened for 90 days to 120 days in the past. And this is obviously worth more than a $400 to that person if they can get up and running and start making money instead of sitting there stagnant. So the temporary license in relation to this is very, very important to us, and so that is the biggest component. Remember, this only does apply to new licensees, so if I am a current bar owner and I want to open up a second establishment, it's not as an extensive of a background check, and you wouldn't have to pay the $400 fee. The other issue that's arisen is, like Sherry's Corporation has 41 licenses, if they get a 10-holder or 10% stockholder change, they would only have to pay the fee once for the background check, not for the 41 licenses that would be changed in that process. So these were some negotiation points that we went through. Obviously, nobody likes to pay more money. We don't necessarily want to pay the $400, but we understand in this situation why it is beneficial, and as long as we get the temporary, that's good. You have the -2 amendments, which I will address next. This is a combination of two different issues as it relates to this bill. Number one, Kate Brown in the Senate introduced a bill 357, which extends the comment period for neighborhood associations to 60 days from 45 today. This is obviously, from our perspective, has to be in conjunction with a temporary license, because if you extend a comment period, that could push our license out farther, so not having a temporary would put us in even more of a problem. And as it relates to that, we have added a fix to what is called the time, place, and manner, which is the first part of that amendment. And what I have handed out is in reference to the judge's comments on this case. The first page is just a cover of the case we filed against the Portland Time, Place, and Manner ordinance, just so you can reference the case if you need to. The second page is just out of the testimony. And the portion I've highlighted for your convenience basically says that this is only supposed to apply things that happen on premise. A lot of the complaints that have been filed under this ordinance have been off-premise. The judge has ruled on this. They continue to be off-premise. And no licensee to this point has been charged or penalized for this, but because after this court ruling they still have not stopped addressing some of these things that happen away from the premise, we want to just make sure that we reaffirm what the judge said in the statute so we don't have to go to court at a later date on these and keep trying to win these things in a court case. Brief description, but I'll let Mr. Lingo or answer questions however you want me to handle it.
Any questions? Representative Kitts.
Bill, I applaud you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's good for business. I think it's good for the industry that you represent. My only question in the fee, the assessment of the fee, and I think if the industry is willing to accept a fee for this and offset, you know, this is good for business, we'll pay the fee because the fee outweighs the benefit, or the benefit outweighs the fee. In just doing the simple math, if the OLCC were to hire four investigators to implement this based on the longer the duration, you know, not having the waiting period, so thus an influx of instant needs for investigation. If there were 1,200 new applicants a year and you had four investigators, that's 300 investigations, if you will, background checks, per investigator. You know, that's under one a day. I mean, that's figuring obviously a 7-day work week. So, but it's not more than two a day investigations. Probably, you know, if you were to do the math out, one point something or other. I just think that the fee seems a little high for my, you know, I mean, and that's just doing out the math of what they're asking for, what the fee generates, the workload that would be incurred on these people. I think that your restaurant folks in this business would, you know, I mean, these people are building a business, and we have mutual friends that own a restaurant in Canby. These people build this business, put all this money into this business. Money's going out, no money's coming in, all throughout the construction phase, not just the 90 to 120 days waiting once you're open and not able to serve. I think these people would be willing to pay more than $400 for that. That doesn't mean it's right or that it's okay or that just because you can extract money from people that are trying to do it, that you do. So my question then becomes, is $400 a set in stone number? Like, I'm going to look at what these numbers add up to based on the range and based on the step in it and what that dollar adds up to, and then I'm going to multiply it out by the number of applicants versus the $400 fee and see where we get with that. That's, so my question is $400 set in stone, or are the provisions just there that's the benefit outweighs the cost in this situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, I appreciate your comments, and I tend to agree with a majority of them. But they, you know, say sometimes the ways justifies the means, and so that's why I think you've got a subsequent referral. They talk about staff positions, and I will tell you I don't spend a lot of time in ways and means, so that is why I think it's been referred to Ways and Means after this, because I do think it's their job to do the calculation.
Okay.
I think you're right in justifying your concerns. It's probably good to share to the person that's just in the office next to you. That is the calculation that's going to go through. I think the number 400 was picked as, this is, I am getting a temporary license. Licenses cost $400, yeah, it's shorter in term, but I think it's a good starting point. If it's too much money, we'll ask it to be lowered, but I really think that that's something that I don't have a good feel for, and I hope that Ways and Means are going to address that question. I'm confident that they will.
Thank you, Bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Shaw.
Whatever the fee is, whatever it costs to get you guys in business, but, and you guys are okay with it. I just hope when we do, and I'm confident in Ways and Means they'll do this, but it's more than just the salary. It's the benefits, it's the room, it's the desk, it's the electric. Mm-hmm. They may need a car, a computer, all that stuff. So when we do our calculating, I'm confident they'll take all that into account. It's more than just the salary of the FTE right there. It represents a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. So I just hope we can get people getting into business with their doors open in a timely fashion and not gouge them. If it pencils out, it's less than 400 necessary, then let's make it less. But I think if you started adding it all up, you may come to it with more. So I don't know. Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Perry? Bill Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your record. Bill Linden, representing 7-Eleven. And I want to talk primarily about the Dash 2 amendments, but I'll just give you a quick few words on the original bill. Conceptually, the faster licenses are issued, the better for the businesses involved. I agree with Mr. Perry's comments that this is going to get worked over thoroughly in the Ways and Means process. We'll make sure the fee is appropriate. And our goal here is to make sure we have a licensing process that is timely, because the quicker the doors can open, the quicker the employment starts, the quicker the income starts flowing in, the quicker the tax money starts flowing out, so it's good for everybody. On the amendments, the provision that gives the cities a longer comment period, I believe, is a very important piece for local government, because in many local government arenas, particularly in the metropolitan area, there's a well-established system of neighborhood associations, all of whom want to weigh in on license applications or renewals. And habitually, there have been complaints about the process being too compacted in terms of time. So the addition of the 15 days, we believe, will make a positive difference in terms of local citizens and neighborhood associations having an opportunity to express any concerns they have to their governing bodies, and which then can be passed along to the commission. So we accept that piece of the Dash 2 amendments. On the issue of the time, place, and manner statute, we believe that this clarification of its application is absolutely crucial to avoiding future litigation. The Portland ordinance just simply, in my opinion, and the opinion of my client, goes way beyond what the time, place, and manner statute was intended to address when it was originally adopted. First of all, it was focused very narrowly on actual nuisances that were occurring on licensed premises that related to drug use and sale, prostitution, and gambling. So it had a narrower focus at the time it was adopted. The Portland ordinance goes way beyond that, and in essence attempts to regulate conduct of patrons once they've left the establishment. So in other words, one of our concerns has been you might have someone who is not visibly intoxicated go into a convenience store, purchase an alcoholic beverage, walk four blocks down the street, go to the park, and create a problem by drinking the beverage in the park and maybe harassing, you know, other park users. But obviously, the licensed establishment does not control the behavior of individuals once they've left. And this amendment makes it clear that we are responsible, and we accept that responsibility for what happens on the licensed premise. And that means both off-premise licenses like 7-Eleven, as well as on-premise licensees like the restaurants and the bars and taverns. And we think gets us back to what the original intent of the time, place, and manner statute was, which is to hold licensees accountable for what they have control over, but to extend it to behavior of patrons after they've left whatever establishment it is. Obviously, that is problematic from our point of view, unenforceable, and we're being asked to be held responsible for it. So I would commend to you the Dash 2 amendments as a very necessary piece of this fix.
Anything else? Any questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate it. Benjamin Walters.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee. I'm Ben Walters. I'm an attorney with the Portland City Attorney's Office. I do not have any written testimony in regard to this, so please bear with me as I try and summarize the city's position on the bill and the amendments. With all due respect, the city does have concerns about the doubling of the license terms. This would present difficulties in trying to address the problems that neighbors have with operations at specific licensed establishments. For now, with a one-year periodic check-in, there's frequent opportunity to check in for the neighbors, and to double this would provide less opportunity. The other complication that's presented by this is that there would be less resources available for cities. In the proposed legislation, the state fee will double, corresponding to a doubling of the term of the license. There is no corresponding increase for the city's application review fee. And under current circumstances, the city estimates that this would reduce revenues for city application processes for review of these renewals by approximately $35,000 a year. And this would reduce the city's ability to fund notification and neighbor outreach processes. So while we applaud the increased time allowed for neighborhood comment in the amendment, this legislation seems to cut both ways in providing less resources for giving such notification. In regard to the time, place, and manner ordinance that is the subject of the amendment, this ordinance was adopted in just about a year ago, in March of 2004, and the ordinance was challenged almost immediately upon adoption on the basis of state preemption, and it was a facial claim. In other words, it wasn't brought because the city was trying to enforce it against a particular location under a particular factual setting. The argument was whether the city was authorized to adopt the regulations as they were assembled by the city council in response to substantial neighborhood testimony. The city had three lengthy public hearings with significant comments from neighborhood associations and neighbors of problem establishments. In the litigation, the court upheld the city's ordinance except in regard to the process of how a licensed establishment would be disqualified from the so-called Responsible Neighbor Program. And the Responsible Neighbor Program was added to the ordinance in response to comments from the licensed establishments regarding being given a reasonable opportunity to identify what problems are without coming under the enforcement aspects of the ordinance. So there's sort of the dog gets three bites, and then you get into the enforcement aspects of the ordinance. And in this particular instance, the court said that the way that the city had set up the process for removal of a licensed establishment from the Responsible Neighborhood Program did not correspond with how the statute was written. So we've gone back and we fixed that to correspond with the court's ruling. The final judgment, as issued by the court and as appealed by the plaintiffs in that case, did not have an interpretation of the city's authority to regulate related activities. It's silent on that. What the judgment merely did was uphold the city's ordinance except in the one minor regard as to the Responsible Neighbor Program. The appeal by the restaurant and tavern of that judge's ruling was recently dismissed by the plaintiffs. And we do not view this as a minor tweak, but as a significant change to the statute. In the council hearings, we heard the council heard testimony from concerned neighbors of licensed establishments affected by litter, noise, and drunken carousing of patrons outside of establishment. The neighbors who testified were frustrated by these types of incidents, and the neighbors' perception by the lack of OLCC resources and responses when issues were brought to the agency's attention. There are a very small number of OLCC inspectors in relation to the concentrated number of licensed establishments within the city of Portland. In the year since adoption, no establishments have been brought before the code hearings officer under the enforcement aspects of the ordinance. The city has been able to work with neighbors and the establishments to resolve the nuisance complaints that have been presented to the city by the neighbors. The first choice is always under this ordinance to seek a responsible neighborhood agreement with the licensed establishment. So turning to the question of what the regulation of nuisances occurring on a licensed premises means, with all due respect, the court that was presented to the court, and the court did not seem to find that there was a problem of whether the city's regulations adhered to the original intent of the statute. The court upheld the city's ordinance. How is the proposed language intended, or what effect will it have on restricting or preempting the city's regulations of nuisances on sites adjacent to or near the licensed establishment? For example, will it affect the city's regulation of tables and chairs on sidewalks in compliance with ADA requirements? Will it affect the city's regulation of broken or cracked sidewalks outside of establishments? Will it address, will the city's ability to regulate litter from off-premise sales be affected? Who will, if this is adopted, who will talk to the young couple with a newborn who had to face down a drunken crowd in a parking lot at 2 a.m., who had exited a bar and had been continuing to party in the parking lot after the bar closed? Who will address the minister to the homeless who lives down in downtown Portland and had been kept awake by crowds partying on an empty lot between two bars at around midnight? Who will help the neighbors who have had to deal with drunks vomiting and urinating in their yards and then going back into taverns?
Benjamin, could we kind of get to the chase here?
I've got about 15 seconds left, sorry. And then... or having to deal with the litter from licensed off-premises establishments blowing across the street. These are specific examples from the testimony offered by neighbors to the city council when this ordinance was being considered. What recourse will these people have, and who will help these people to deal with their problems if this amendment is adopted and put into place? That's all in my testimony, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Schaffler.
You know, you're doing pretty good till the end there, Mr. Walters. You're trying to tell me that a couple with a newborn who, for God knows what reason, is in the parking lot of a tavern at 2 a.m. with a newborn, has no recourse if a bunch of drunken brawlers harass them. I don't believe it. And I'm going to follow up. I'm going to continue on here. The broken sidewalk, I know for a fact the city is very, very, very good at maintaining and watching, excuse me, not maintaining, but dealing with broken sidewalks whenever they get the time and money to send staff out to condemn them. I think this kind of hysterical testimony really damaged your credibility, in my opinion. Now, I understand the nuisance issues. I understand all that. But to pile on there at the end, I'm sorry, it really, really, really took away from your credibility. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to Representative Schaffler, just a clarification. The young couple with a newborn, they lived across the street, and the carousing at 2 a.m. woke them up, their newborn. He had to go across the street to confront them, and he came in and testified that this was an ongoing problem and that he had tried to deal with the licensed establishment and was not successful in arriving at a mutually agreeable arrangement, and so he came in to testify in support of the ordinance, and that was what was
first of all, Mr. Walters, he should have called the police department, not go out and confront anyone. But aside from that, Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I Representative Schaffler hit on a lot of points. I think, Mr. Walters, you have absolutely done a wonderful job of articulating why people don't want to do business in Multnomah County and why they're fleeting by the droves to Washington County and Clackamas County, because everything you said is less revenue, less fees, less ability to enforce regulations, broken sidewalks, whatever else. I mean, these things are reasons why people don't start businesses. It's because you have come forward with every objection that is just the nuance of why I ran for office, is because people like you and Multnomah County want to jump in here and regulate the heck out of people, fee the heck out of people, which is why Mr. Steubenfall will know that every time he comes before my committee or the committee that I sit on with a fee, that he better be able to justify it. I just, it's absurd. I'm sorry that you wasted your time here today.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. Now, my turn. First of all, who do they turn to? They better be turning to their community and their city. That's your job. That's not OLCC's job for off-site problems. That is an ordinance of nuisance. We have those established in any municipality in this state. So if you aren't adhering to your law, you aren't adhering to your law. I'm sorry. The fee, that seems to be a big question with you. $35,000 a year just to hear people. I know a lot of municipalities that do it free because they feel it's their job. The second thing is, cannot anyone that you've talked about, if there's a problem within the establishment, can they not file at the OLCC a complaint?
Chair, yes, they can. And the problem that was addressed to the City Council was that they did not feel that their complaints were being taken seriously and that there was follow-up.
But what you're described mostly was, in my opinion, the lack of response of your police department. That's what you were describing to me. So, having said that, is there anything else? Yeah. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to say that you wasted your time. I appreciate your concerns. The frustration there is when you have 1,200 applicants and they want four new inspectors, yeah. That's one a day. I think that they have the ability to do and seek the recourse that you're looking to have done. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. I'll close the public hearing. Nothing else? We'll adjourn.